The White Network presents Saturday Afternoon with Carolyn. Your host, Carolyn Yeager.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Saturday Afternoon with me, your host, Carolyn Yeager. It is February 23rd, 2013. I'm very happy for those of you who have joined me here are here, and it's always nice to have an audience when you're speaking. So today my show is about, as I told you it would be, about two men that I think should be talked about who gave more of a contribution to the National Socialist regime of Adolf Hitler than they are usually given credit for. So I will tell you right now that the names of these two people are Arthur Rudolph, the rocket scientist, and Julius Streicher, the newspaper owner and journalist. Yesterday, the Justice Department joined a federal whistleblower lawsuit claiming that Lance Armstrong, his former team manager and the company that owned his cycling team and so on, defrauded the government because the team was sponsored by the United States Postal Service, and they were breaking the rules and therefore in a sense, defrauding the United States Postal Service. And the Justice Department thinks they need to take up that cause. The attorney for the Justice Department for the District of Columbia is Ronald C. Machen, Jr., a black man. And the firm for another lawsuit that's brought against them by the supposedly called the whistleblowers. The lawyer for that is Gordon Schnell, who I couldn't tell. I can't tell. I couldn't find out if he's Jewish or not. He could be or he could not be. In any case, they have that Schnell is the attorney for Constantine Cannon, which is a plaintiff because Armstrong and his associates took more than $30 million. In any case, they're a plaintiff because they were a sponsor also, all right? They were a sponsor of Lance Armstrong. Now, Lance Armstrong's estimated worth is about $125 million, and I don't know whether anybody has any sympathy for him or not, but the whistleblower lawsuits and then the federal government joining in for the U.S. Postal Service could cause a jury to award triple damages, which in this case could add up to something more than $90 million, which would take a great deal of his wealth. Now, again, I don't have any big opinion about Lance Armstrong, but he's a white man, and I think this is being done so aggressively against him because he's a white man and he's a white famous sports figure. And as we see, it's always when you're not white, you get off easy, and when you're white, they go all out after you. So I have sympathy for him for that reason. And I'm just using that as I get into this story about Arthur Rudolph, who I'm going to talk about first in this first hour, because he was targeted by the Justice Department of the United States, a special branch of it at the time, because he was white and a white German, because he was a part of the someone who was a former Nazi and therefore was fair game for these, in this case, Jews who were who decided to persecute him and make an example of him, and they succeeded in doing so. And I'm going to tell this story. It's going to include a lot about the deceit that goes on in our government, and how, and also how the Jews have, you know, when they manage to take over in an area, they get such power and no one is willing or able to put a stop to what they're doing. And that's what happened in this case, even though there are many, many good people who complained about it and tried to do something. They were never successful. So what I've got here, and I don't know quite how to start, because maybe I will start out by reading Arthur Rudolph's obituary in the New York Times. I've got some notes from that, and also from Wikipedia. Maybe I'll just go to the Wikipedia and do that, and then I'll see, just have some details about him. And then I'll look at the, I didn't have time before the show to compare those two and put them together and see, you know, so repeating myself, but I'll be able to tell. So I'll just start here that this man, Arthur Rudolph, a German, was born in Stepferhausen mining in Germany in 1906. His family were farmers with a long tradition in the area. His father died in World War I in 1915. And so he, you know, his mother had to raise he and his brother. I forget now if he had one brother or more than that. But anyway, the brother took over the farm, and Arthur had talent in technical things, his mother noticed, and so she sent him to a technical school. Anyway, on May 1st, 1930, now this would have been when he was 24 years old, he began working for the Haland Works in Berlin. He was an ambitious and hardworking, you know, guy, intelligent, and he met rocketry pioneer Max Valier there. I just think this little bit of background is good to show what kind of a person he was. He had, Valier had this use of some factory grounds, and he was doing experiments in rocketry, and Rudolph became interested in working with him in that, and along with a man named Walter Riedel. And the from that, the Highland H... Highland, H-E-Y-L-A-N-D-T rocket car was born, or, you know, came into being and was exhibited at Tempelhof Aerodrome. In 1931, Arthur Rudolph joined the Nazi Party, and then later he joined the SA. Now, I've never heard anything about what he did in the SA. I guess you could just join it. I don't know. I'm pleased that he was a member of the Nazi Party and that he joined in 1931. Later we'll have a statement that he gave to the FBI explaining why he did this. So in May 1932, he moved to the proving grounds at Kummersdorf along with this Riedel and began working under von Braun, Walter von Braun, the famous one that everybody knows about. In December 1934, the von Braun team was successfully launched two A2 rockets from the island of Borkum. They were then moved, this team was then moved to Peenemünde in May 1937. Of course, now Hitler was the Führer, and it was a National Socialist government, and doing very, very well, and, you know, gaining all of its goals that it had set and so on. And so everything was going well. And Rudolph was tasked with the building of the A3 test stand. He and his wife and daughters lived in nearby Zinnowitz, and their daughter was born, in 1937. In early 1938, Dornberger put Rudolph in charge of the design for the new production plant to be built at Peenemünde for the A4 series, which was later renamed the V2. The V2 stood for, a German word, Vergelstungswaffe, terrible, Vergelstungswaffe. Waffe means air. Anyway, it means reprisal weapon, too. It was the second one, because the first one, A3 series failed. But then they worked on this one, and this one worked, and it was, naming it a reprisal weapon seems to me to be that it was meant, even though it was still 1938, it was meant to be used if necessary for being attacked, and this was what they could have something really good to respond with. So in August 1943, we jump forward as Rudolph was ready to begin production of the V2, the British bombed Peenemünde, and the production facility was then moved to Mittelwerk, a facility near Nordhausen. Mittelwerk was originally a gypsum mine that was being used as a storage facility and was being excavated for production facilities. The labor force consisted of the prisoners who were eventually housed, or consisted of prisoners who were eventually housed at the Mittelbau Dora concentration camp. A whole lot has been made about that camp, because that was where the prisoners were sent, the ones who were going to work on this, on these rockets. And of course, they hate that so much, so they try to make that into something really evil. Rudolph was in charge of moving the equipment from Peenemünde to Mittelwerk, under the direction of Albin Sawatzki. And after the plant was in place, Rudolph was operations director for V2 missile production. Now, you know, the fact that these men later went to United States and were supposedly, you know, not really Nazis or something. Well, we have to recognize that when they were there in Germany, they were patriotic Germans. They were Germans. They believed in what they were doing. They believed that they were Germany was under attack, and they believed a lot of things. And they were working for, like all people do, working for their own nation without any sense of doing anything wrong, but in fact doing something very right. So by March 1945, though, almost to the end, the production was stopped due to a lack of parts, and Rudolph and his staff were moved to I always have trouble with this name of this place, Oberammergau, where they met von Braun, who was sent there too, I guess, or was there, and others from Peenemünde. They finally surrendered. They all surrendered to the U.S. Army and were transported to Garmisch. at that time, of course, they didn't know what was happening to all these German POWs. You know, they're trying to get these Germans, these highly technical Germans with all their knowledge, to cooperate with them. And at the same time, Eisenhower is setting up his camps and putting all these, he had already done this by this time, putting all these POWs, taking away their POW status and putting them in these camps where they were dying by the thousands of starvation. All this going on, but these men would not have known anything about that, because who knew, you know? Who knew about it? It wasn't being advertised. And they were in custody by the Americans. They were first transferred to the British from July to October 1945 to participate in Operation Backfire, which was part of the Britain's attempt to get German technology. There was this scramble, you know, they call it a scramble, but there was this real competition between the Americans and the British. And then there would be the Russians, too, but mainly the Americans and British were really competing their intelligence departments and so on to get hold of as much German, not only technology, but everything of value that they had, to get it for themselves in their own country. And so they were working, they were allowed to help the British for a while, but then in November of that, of 1945, I don't really understand how this worked, but they were brought, Operation Overcast, which was an American operation, brought Rudolf, von Braun, and the rest of the V2 team temporarily to the United States for 6 months. Maybe they had an agreement. You have them for, you know, so many months and then we'll have them. But they, of course, they never left. Overcast was renamed Operation Paperclip in March 1946 and formally approved by President Truman in August 1946. And most of the group stayed then, permanently in the United States. In January of 47, and this is just giving you the outline of what Rudolf did in the United States during the time that he was there, how he was used, and so on. In January 1947, he was moved to the Ordnance Research and Development Division at Fort Bliss, El Paso, Texas, where his family finally joined him in April. Since he had been brought to the U.S. without a visa, he and others were sent to Juarez, Mexico, where he obtained a visa and officially immigrated to the United States on April 14, 1949. This is how the U.S. government had to do these things, because they had to follow their own laws, sort of outwardly, and they couldn't just bring these guys over and make them citizens. But he came in as an immigrant from Mexico, and on a special visa, and then eventually that got changed. But during the 1949 inquiry by the FBI, Rudolf made the following statement on his participation in the Nazi Party. And I'm going to quote that now, but this is from Wikipedia, and I have a little, I never trust it, and you don't know what else he might have said. I mean, what he said here is fine, but it's just one part of it. But he said, until 1930, and naturally he's not going to be, gung-ho for any of that now that he's in the United States and he's talking to the FBI. But anyway, he does a respectable job here. He says, until 1930, I sympathized with the Social Democratic Party, voted for it, and was a member of a Social Democratic Union, gives the name of it. And he says, after 1930, the economical situation became so serious that it appeared to me to be headed for a catastrophe. I really became unemployed, he says, in 1932. The great amount of unemployment caused expansion of National Socialist and Communistic parties. Frightened that the latter would become the government, that is the communists, I joined the NSDAP, a legally registered entity, to help in that direction, that it not become communist, and he preferred the National Socialist program. Said, I believed in the preservation of the Western culture. Well, that's what he thinks he's doing. That's what these men thought they were doing when they cooperated with the Americans, because they were so, everybody in Germany was so clear that the biggest enemy was the Soviets and communism, that they didn't want to help them. And the only other choice was to help the Americans, who said that they wanted to fight the Soviets now also, that they, this was, at least they were Western and not Eastern. So this is how all this went down. So that's the only thing I have from that interview. So he was finally naturalized as an American citizen on November 11th, 1954 in Birmingham, Alabama. And in 1950, he was appointed as a technical director. This is 4 years before that, for the Redstone Missile Project. He was assigned as the project manager for the Pershing Missile Project in 1956. He later became the project director. Notice he's always the project director and the director of it, of the Saturn V rocket program in August 1963. He developed the requirements for the rocket system and the mission plan for the Apollo program. The first Saturn V launch lifted off from Kennedy Space Center and performed flawlessly on November 9, 1967, which was his birthday. He was then assigned as a special assistant to the director of MS, FC, that would be something, in May 1968, and then he retired from NASA on January 1st, 1969. Since he was born in 1906, he was, what, 63 years old. During his tenure, he was awarded the NASA Exceptional Service Medal and the NASA Distinguished Service Medal. And on July 16th, 1969, on July 16th, yeah, the final of the Saturn V launched Apollo 11, putting a man on the moon. Thanks very much thanks to him. So in 1979, Eli Rosenbaum of the OSI, by chance, it says, read about Rudolph in a book about moving rocket parts using forced labor, I don't know, something's missing here, period or something, using forced labor. Okay, so now 10 years after the Apollo mission, this Jew was in the OSI. Now, the OSI was the Office of Special Investigations. And they had convinced, the Justice Department, the State Department, the government, that they needed to, that they should be able to have that. And they were all Jews in there. And they needed to be looking for Nazi war criminals who were hiding out in the United States. And, you know, whenever they do things like that, our governments just cave in and go along. They go, oh, well, what can it hurt? You know, we don't want Nazi war criminals. And we're anti-Nazi, and never thinking what these people would be up to. I suppose most of them didn't think that, if they weren't Jewish. But this thing was filled with Jews, and they were searching around. So this idea that this guy by chance read about Rudolph is, I don't believe it. Not that it's a big, important issue, but no doubt they were looking for who they could target. And they were certainly not going to target Werner. Did I call him Walter earlier? Werner von Braun, because he was just too, he was too popular and big, handsome guy. And, you know, everybody knew of him, and they would not do that. So they looked for someone else that was, and here was Arthur Rudolph, who was not particularly good looking, was kind of short and, quiet and modest and went about doing all the great work that he did, but didn't gain a whole lot of attention. And, he had this history, and he ran this, this program, you know, where they were using the prisoner labor, and, they just built up what they thought was a superficial case against him. They never had a real solid case. They just had this superficial case. And we'll look into, I'm going to be looking into how they went about this. So I need to move along here. He supposedly conducted research about the Dora war crimes trial in Germany. And he connected it all together. And in September 1982, 3 years later or so, Rudolph received a letter requesting an interview by the Office of Special Investigations. Well, he had had so many interviews and interrogations, he thought this was just another one, you know, so he just went for it without any idea what it was going to be about. And this was the first of three interviews, and it centered on his attitudes on racial superiority, his early participation in the Nazi Party, and a possible role in the treatment of prisoners at Mittelwerk. So, and these were all Jews. So just think how a former National Socialist and a member of National Socialist Germany, an active participant in National Socialist Germany, being interrogated by Jews. And, you know, how could it possibly turn out? So this is where most accounts leave it. They say, well, after all this, Rudolph voluntarily left for the United States, for Germany. He left the United States. He voluntarily gave up his U.S. citizenship and went back to Germany After hearing, after talking to these Office of Special Investigations people, that is not the way it went. And that's what I'm going to tell you now. I didn't look in here through this obituary to see if there's anything that I, important that's in here that I left out. But, it's going to come out in the other, so I'll just go ahead now. What I've got here and what caused me to want to do this, talk about him today was that I was cleaning out my files, my computer files, and I came upon this, which I had received, I don't know when, quite some time ago, and just saved it and never remembered even. I don't even remember what's in my files, so it was good that I found a lot of things that were there. Well, this is written by William E. Winterstein, Sr., a lieutenant colonel, retired of the Army, United States Army. And it's titled, and he worked very hard on behalf of truth and justice for Arthur Rudolph. And this is what he wrote about it. I think he can be trusted pretty much to be accurate. He titled it, Senator Biden's, our current vice president, Senator Biden's refusal to investigate the OSI's character assassination of space hero stifles building of monument. Okay, America represented space history truthfully for a short period of time, from July 1969 to March 1984. The American flag and footprints were firmly placed on the moon. The American citizens most responsible were acclaimed as space heroes. They included Arthur Rudolph, the manager of the Saturn V program, who built the giant rocket boosters which took our astronauts to the moon, and Dr. Werner von Braun, his boss. Excuse me. Let me get a drink of water. Rudolph, a distinguished U.S. citizen at the time, was awarded NASA's highest award, the Distinguished Service Medal. He also received commendations in the Congressional Record. Officials in the Office of Special Investigations of the Department of Justice began their criminal activity in 1982, targeting Rudolph because he was the production manager of the V-2 line in wartime Germany. The OSI was a small organizational element in the Department of Justice. Formed in 1979, as soon as it was formed, this guy discovered Rudolph, this Rosenbaum, to find World War II Nazi war criminals who may have entered this country after the war and to deport them. The investigation of Rudolph soon developed into a fiendish plot concerning a distinguished American citizen and a top national space hero. OSI didn't have legitimate evidence to substantiate a prosecution procedure of Rudolph in 1982. They were fully aware of the outcome of Dachau war crimes trial in 1947, where Rudolph was not even a defendant. Further, in a diplomatic note from the U.S. Embassy in Berlin, they requested aid from the East German prosecutor, a recognized enemy of the United States at the time, if the prosecutor had any evidence against Rudolph. Surprisingly, the response was negative. So here these Jews, this infiltration in the Justice Department, not that there weren't tons of other Jews helping him out there, but while they had made these claims against Rudolph, they were at the same time still looking for evidence, and they were looking for it from East Germany, which was an enemy country, to find if they had any evidence against Rudolph, and they didn't have any. Now, the first two interviews with Rudolph in late 1982 and early 1983 were on a friendly basis. Rudolph had many interviews, and he thus feared no evil, and he cooperated fully with the OSI. Never trust a Jew. In the third interview in September of 1983, tactics changed dramatically. The OSI previously had requested Rudolph to have his attorney present. From then on, Rudolph was barred at OSI request from all discussions between his attorney and the OSI officials. See? Thus, Rudolph was placed under great duress during the remainder of the OSI visit and afterward, as all communication by phone or correspondence was between his attorney and the OSI. Now, I don't know where he got his attorney, you know? I don't know how loyal his attorney was to him. I don't know much about this attorney, and there's not much said here. But he didn't seem to do what he needed to do. During all of this, Rudolph was not shown. And now Rudolph, you can see, was a good man, a decent man, like so many, like typically Germans are, and just didn't see the evil that was coming down on him. Though he, you know, and he didn't know how to react to it either. During all this, he was not shown any incriminating document or given a name of an OSI witness, only the impression that the OSI possessed an impressive amount of documentation and witnesses against him. In the period after September 1983 and November 1983, when Rudolph signed an agreement drafted by the OSI, there were numerous phone calls between the attorney and the OSI. So, you know, between September and November, in November he signed this thing, but before that, there were numerous phone calls between his attorney and the OSI, and Rudolph didn't know what was going on. And Rudolph firmly objected to sign the agreement containing false allegations of treatment of slave laborers and other irregularities and a veiled threat against members of his family if he didn't sign it. Now there, coming from the Justice Department, not only false allegations, but a veiled threat against members of his family, which would make that whole thing, that agreement, unconstitutional and null and void. He didn't want to sign it, and it says here briefly the agreement provided that if Rudolph left the country, surrendered his U.S. citizenship, never appealed his case, the government would continue his retirement pay and Social Security benefits and not investigate the U.S. citizenship of members of his family. Well, his daughter was there living, I think, in California. This comes up in a little bit. But and she, I think, had a family already. And he didn't want, you know, they said, well, we won't bother her. His attorney advised him to sign. You see, his attorney should never have advised him to sign. His attorney should know that it was, that this was not, that they didn't have anything. His attorney did know. So therefore, his attorney was not really working for him. His attorney had been turned, and that's why they didn't allow him to be involved in any of this between his attorney and the OSI. And the Justice Department was allowing this to go on. Allowing it to go on. And, you know, the thing was that I learned that if Rudolph would have talked to people about this, if he would have said something, all his friends and supporters would have come to his aid, and this would not have, you know, probably the outcome would have been different. But, you know, he didn't say anything to anyone. I think he was, it all happened pretty fast. And he hadn't said anything, I can't say why he didn't, but probably because it was just that typical German way of keeping it to yourself and not bothering people or whatever. Anyway, briefly, I read that already. So his attorney advised him to sign, as the OSI was becoming very aggressive and could have rescinded all agreements. That is, this was now presented as some goodwill thing given to him, that, you know, he would not lose out on his pay and he would not lose out on his family would not be harmed if he would just agree to sign this thing that he was guilty of all these things and go and leave voluntarily, give up his citizenship and leave the country. So it says that finally he signed the agreement in November 1983, something he shouldn't have done. He followed the instructions in the agreement, returning to Germany in March 1984, so a few months later. The government of West Germany promptly protested to the United States State Department that Rudolph was an illegal immigrant and wanted him returned to the United States. After some sleazy political gymnastics on the part of the United States, Rudolph remained in Germany, another reason why the agreement was faulty. That is, there's some political stuff was going on which was not honorable. So, continuing, the OSI was promptly dealt a blow to their plot by the West German war crimes prosecutor, who requested that the Justice Department furnish a copy of the Rudolph prosecution file to them, something that Rudolph had never seen, what they had. He just thought they had all this stuff because they told him they did. And it turns out that such a file did not exist. The OSI had no evidence against Rudolph. The German prosecutor... Where am I? I jumped. Something jumped here. Okay. The German prosecutor was faced with the problem of having a distinguished American citizen and space hero dumped into his lap, being accused as a war criminal. This called for immediate action by Germany for an investigation. The German prosecutor made repeated requests for the file, and it took about a year for the OSI to respond, which it finally did in April 1985. But far from being a prosecution file, the response sent by the OSI was a three-page letter with a list of 9 witnesses and some documentation. The prosecutor found, the German prosecutor found, that 4 of the witnesses did not know Rudolph. 1 testified for Rudolph, 2 contradicted themselves, and 2 were mentally incompetent. There wasn't 1 shred of evidence in the documentation against Rudolph. This indeed was a devastating and embarrassing international blow against the American system of justice, against how the American system of justice was meted out to stop a space hero. Well, this isn't written very well. The OSI then attempted to make a case about Rudolph after they had illegally exiled him from the country by enlisting the help of the World Jewish Congress. And what does the World Jewish Congress govern? What do they have to do with it? But the World Jewish Congress started advertising in the news media for witnesses against Rudolph. This was at this late date. This was then, because it says the OSI had illegally, what information they had gained by the help of the World Jewish Congress in advertising in the news media for witnesses. In this effort, they did not receive one response against Rudolph, you know. They received a very strong response defending Rudolph from the only American concentration camp prisoner who worked on the V2 production line under Rudolph. So obviously here what he's saying is that there was, he's an American now. He probably wasn't then, but he, you know, someone who was a survivor who came to America, immigrated to America, is now an American. And he worked there, and he was speaking up for Rudolph, was probably doing the best he could to, you know, for their conditions and so on. It says the OSI failed to forward this response to the German prosecutor. And this was a crime of obstruction of justice, which is a felony. So this OSI should be in big trouble here for its behavior and its tactics. But we'll see. The German prosecutor thoroughly investigated, taking over 2 years and generating over 2,100 pages of transcript finding. So this German prosecutor worked very hard at it to get to the bottom of it, because he had to have some kind of ruling on Rudolph in Germany. So he found that Rudolph was not guilty of any war crime. The German government then granted him German citizenship. Also, he found that the OSI failed to produce evidence to support their allegations against Rudolph. When this news was made public, Neil Scheer, then director of the OSI, Neil Scheer, N-E-A-L, his last name S-H-E-R, he's been around for a long time, violated the agreement by announcing in a public news release that the U.S. still considers Rudolph a war criminal. Now, that was the agreement said they would not do anything like that, but he did it in order to protect himself, since the Germans said he was not a war criminal. There was no evidence, and yet he just puts out in the news media that, well, here in the U.S., we still think he is. Now, Congress members and others who sent inquiries into the circumstances of the Rudolph case required a response from the Department of Justice. They said, well, you need to answer for this. What the heck's going on here? Now, the department knew they needed a cover-up story. There was our Department of Justice, as they could not reveal the true circumstances that he was exiled without the evidence to support such an action. The cover-up was delegated to assistant attorney generals, and I have, says this writer of this, evidence of three who engaged in the following practice of writing letters which contained gross, outright lies. Here I quote the standard paragraphs from the letters. I want to emphasize, this is from Department of Justice assistant attorney generals, right under the attorney general. I want to emphasize that Rudolph was represented by competent counsel, and when faced with incontrovertible documentary evidence, he freely and voluntarily entered into an agreement to leave this country and renounce his citizenship, and he did so. Let me assure you that before proceeding in cases such as the Rudolph matter, we at the Department of Justice carefully review the evidence and weigh its credibility. We proceed only after we are convinced that the evidence supports the allegations. Unquote. Coming from an assistant attorney general in the Department of Justice, this quote convinced most of those seeking an answer that the department had an airtight case against Rudolph. But let us now look at the documentary evidence revealing that John R. Bolton, you know, he's one of those neocons, John Bolton, the assistant attorney general, deliberately lied to Senator Pete Wilson when Wilson was assisting me in getting the attention of the department in January 1987. Well, what's new about that? The almost unbelievable part of the Rudolph case is in the documentation concerning two organizational elements of the Department of Justice. Assistant attorney generals were lying to members of Congress and others that Rudolph was shown unquestionable evidence against him when the OSI was trying to build a case by advertising in the news media for evidence against him to submit to the German prosecutor. Any dedicated investigator would soon discover that Rudolph was illegally prosecuted and exiled without one shred of evidence in the Department of Justice to justify such actions. The most despicable crimes that the OSI committed against Rudolph was the introduction of House Resolutions Resolution 68 of 1985 and House Resolution 164 of 1987. Congress did not adopt the resolutions, yet they remain in the public record permanently. Okay, this is one another way they do things to slander people. They say, well, legally they didn't want to do it, but there they are in the public record. They both contain gross, contemptuous, degrading, humiliating lies that Rudolph is a war criminal, placing him under national contempt and ridicule. It is the ultimate, of course, it wouldn't, I don't see it that way. I could care less what the national belief is about Germans and war criminals. But most of the people, of course, to most people, I mean, this is something that's very, very harmful to your reputation. So it is the ultimate insult that a nation can give a top space hero. Congress is participating in a hate crime against Rudolph every day that the resolutions remain in the public record. The introduction of the House resolution was the beginning of the contamination of American space history, according to this guy who wants to, who's a patriotic American and wants America to be what he thinks it is, and not what it actually is. But anyway, he says the Smithsonian Institution copyrighted a book in 1995 called titled The Rocket and the Reich, which contains lies about Rudolph. So this stuff, you know, spreads around, and it's in this book about American space history, these lies about him. That's shameful. Also, most of the major TV networks, naturally, have had programs with inaccurate episodes about America's entry into the space age. There also have been a number of publications giving false or inaccurate accounts of our space history. Another episode of criminal intent of the OSI was when knowing Rudolph, now this is really interesting. When they knew that Rudolph was visiting Canada in July 1990, they spoiled his vacation by informing, okay, he came to Canada from Germany, you know, because now he was a German citizen in good standing and he could travel. And he came to, this is after all this took place, he came to Canada. They spoiled his vacation by informing, this is the way they do, Canadian authorities that Rudolph was considered a war criminal by the United States. Upon Rudolph's arrival at Montreal, of course, I don't know if he was or not, you know, really, legally, officially, but upon Rudolph's arrival at Montreal, he was seized by the police and held in protective custody for a number of hours and questioned. He was released on bail to continue his vacation. He was later ordered into court for further investigation. And the court found that the OSI had not given them the evidence to support their allegations. Thus, the OSI had embarrassed the American system of justice to a second foreign nation, Canada, inviting international ridicule and contempt, but also caused him a lot of harass and stress and so on. And what would you call that when you have to go through things like that, when you're not, you know, based on lies, when it's about being a Nazi, you know, and a war criminal. I mean, that's really nasty stuff. He says that it was just after the Canadian episode wherein the Canadian court rebuffed the OSI plot against Rudolph due to lack of evidence that I approached Senator Biden in 1991. My request was very clearly a subject for the oversight investigation by the Senate Judiciary Committee, of which he was chairman. He was chairman of that committee for a long time. I suppose he was in 1991, unless he was just a member at the time. But the OSI plot against Rudolph had developed into a governmental nightmare and morass involving deceit, contempt for justice, assassination of character, hate crimes, and illegal prosecution and exile, all of which emanated within the Department of Justice and the House of Congress. The present situation concerning the Arthur Rudolph case, one of our top space pioneers and heroes, is an almost unbelievable story considering the behavior of government officials involved. Rudolph died in 1996 as a German citizen in Hamburg. The OSI illegally prosecuted, exiled, and induced him under duress to sign an illegal agreement surrendering his U.S. citizenship. Later in 1985 and 1987, the OSI maneuvered the plot for the national character assassination of Rudolph by having two House resolutions introduced into the congressional record. Now, you know, this is a summary of what we've already covered. This move by the OSI placed the House in the untenable situation of being hypocritical in the public record, because there in plain English is laudatory praise to Rudolph in 1969 and then a character assassination in 1985 and 1987. The OSI was behind the cover-up of the Rudolph case by the Department of Justice, wherein, and that's, you know, all Jews, and it was a Jewish idea. It was this anti-Nazi thing. Probably Simon Wiesenthal Center had something to do with it. I'm sure he was involved, you know, with coming up with this idea, because he's a big Nazi hunter, and they support all of this kind of thing. And the stupid United States Justice Department and government goes along with it. Wherein So they were behind the cover-up wherein assistant generals were lying to members of Congress, the department possessed unquestionable evidence against Rudolph. So, they repeat that they were still at that time advertising for witnesses to trying to build a case. Now he ends by saying, Americans cannot now erect a national monument commemorating mankind's greatest technological achievement, our journey to the moon, until some action is taken to correct the following mistakes. The Senate Judiciary Committee, I believe, would be the appropriate governmental unit to accomplish the task. 1, remove the House resolutions from the public record and inform the American public for the reasons therefor. 2, restore United States citizenship to Arthur Rudolph posthumously as he died a German citizen. 3, initiate action that a national monument be erected to commemorate America's journey to the moon and honor the individuals or group that accomplished the mission. Well, I think a little differently from most people. And while this probably would not be the wish of the Rudolph family, I think it should stay as it is. But maybe it doesn't work that way. I don't know. You know, as an example of what Jews in our government do and how corrupt they are and how they target their particular enemies, which always are Germans who have something to do with the Nazis, and for the most part. And so, you know, for me to wipe all this away is kind of, I don't like to wipe things away without making a real clear case about who's guilty. So that just is what comes to my mind. He finished off by saying, had Senator Biden granted my request that an investigation be made of the operational conduct of the OSI in 1991, when he was chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, it would have halted the historical morass of deceit, hate, and distortion of our legacy, which is evident today. We want our history reflected in truth. Well, if you wipe all that away, it's still not going to be in truth, because you have to keep this episode and talk about it. And now we know Biden is a Israel lover. We know that he's a Jew lover, and he was even then. And so he did not grant the request of this retired army, what was he, general of some kind, a lieutenant colonel, sorry. So these higher ups aren't going to do this, but he was a lieutenant colonel, so he has more courage to try to do the right thing. But you know, he wouldn't help him. He wouldn't help. And then my comment here is that, because on my point here in all my programs, and certainly in this program, is to point out how the Jews are the persecutors and not the persecuted. The Jews use this idea that they are the most persecuted people and continue to get sympathy. And just as they got this OSI set into the Justice Department of the United States so they could go around hunting down who they considered to be Nazis and in this illegal means, not really even using proper legality in their part of the legal system of our country, to do it. You know, it's just, this is a part of what we need to know and we educate other people about to unravel and reveal the hate crimes and the hate that is in the Jewish people to other people and to who they consider their enemies, and that they're not the victims. And there will be more of this coming from me, and I hope from others, because this is one of the major scams that the Jews use, that they still convince most of the people that they are the most persecuted group of people in history. And this is why they're God's chosen, because God wants them to be so good and so perfect. And he puts them through all these challenges that they have to face, and they have always faced them, and, you know, blah, blah. And they have suffered more than anyone else, and this makes them a special people. And all this crud that people believe, unfortunately. One of the major areas that needs to be overturned, and we need to show the rot underneath this and the untruth of it. And this is just one example. One example. Who was the criminal here? It wasn't Arthur Rudolph. It was these American Jews. And with the help of the Jewish Congress, the International Jewish Congress, all this stuff, you know, they're all helping all over the world. So the criminality is not so much what this Jewish cabal and the OSI wanted to do and did, but that the Justice Department allowed them to do it. Because, you know, what the Jews do, it's their nature and it's their aim in life. This is what they do. And we have to learn that we cannot allow them to do it. So this is the end of hour one, and I finished this. At least that's as far as I can talk about it. And I'll be going on to Julia Streicher in hour two. So stay with me. And let me remind you that the call-in number is 1-830-443-4911. You can call in, and now when we get into the second hour, and I will take your call, 1-830-443-4911. I probably won't repeat this when we come back from the break. And please enjoy the new music that I have. Not even sure which one I have for Saturday afternoon. Oh, I know. It's the aria from Mozart's Zaida.
Oh!
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is Carolyn Yeager with Saturday Afternoon with Carolyn on February 23rd, 2013. And I'm talking about Jewish hate crimes and Jewish hate against their enemies and how, why we need to focus on what they do to us and to others rather than what anybody has done to them, because it's there's a lot that is never talked about along those lines. And I talked about Arthur Rudolph, the space scientist, the space rocket expert, and who was responsible for the Saturn V rocket that launched the Apollo spacecraft to the moon for the United States of America, and how he was later treated. And now I'm going to turn to Julia Stryker, who I'm sure many of you will enjoy hearing about. I want to remind you that what you just heard during the break, the music was by a beautiful young woman singing, Moshka Erdman, singing a aria. I forget, from Zaida. Oh, yes, Sleep Softly is the name of it. And it was an unfinished opera by Mozart. So before I get started here with Stryker, I will just mention again to introduce this subject that currently the Simon Wiesenthal Center is still in its, even though he died and was exposed as such a liar, they're still going strong, and they are, you know, trying to track down so-called Nazi war criminals. Now, the latest is they're after this. They've tracked down this 97-year-old Laszlo Kastari. He's Hungarian. And he's living, they found him in a two-bedroom apartment in Budapest. And he is alleged, you know, all of these allegations are false. I mean, they're just crazy. He's alleged to have sent 15,700 Jews to their deaths in Auschwitz. Well, if he was working with the police or something, the Hungarian police, you know, but he didn't personally do that. And these people weren't going to their deaths either. Do they have the names of all of them? Do they have the names of these 15,700? And the fact that they died in Auschwitz, that they were sent there and then they were murdered there or something? Or they died of other reasons there? No, but he was, he was the chief of police in the city of Kosice in Slovakia. So that makes him guilty, you know, I mean, of all of this. And Serge Klarsfeld says that there won't be any trial because they protect him. Well, they should. They should protect him from stuff like this. In Hungary, Hungary is doing a better job than most, that's for sure. And, they try to make him look bad by saying that a Czech court issued a death sentence on him after a trial held in his absence. It held in absentia in 1948. So, you know, in 1948, Czechs were under communist rule. This was all communist. So naturally, they're you know, finding all these Nazi people who cooperated with the National Socialists guilty of one thing or another. And so to get away from that, he fled to Canada, and then he returned in 1995 from Canada. Anyway, you know, this is just more of this that's going on. I want to move right now to Julia Stryker, and why I want to talk about him is that I think, and I have felt for a long time, I've just naturally felt good feelings, you know, positive feelings toward him. I like him. I don't buy into all that criticism that he was such a crude guy and just stupid, and that nobody in the party liked him, and so on and so forth. I never did quite buy into that. And the fact is, looking at the facts, okay, about this man, starting really with with the Nuremberg trial, we're going to start with it and end with it. He had absolutely nothing to do with the German planning or conduct of World War II. He was, during the war, not even in the government. He was among those found guilty of war crimes at Nuremberg, though. The only reason was that he was so effective in exposing many hidden facts about Jews. That's why the Jews hate him so much and try to act like the whole world hated him, and even Germans hated him, because of the things that he said about Jews were so nasty. His world-famous weekly newspaper, Der Stürmer, frankly discussed the Jewish problem, which not so many others did, including their founding of communism, conspiring against Christianity. He was a Christian. And using their great financial resources to subvert governments, and also the forming of monopolies to wipe out Christian-owned small businesses, which they did. These were the kind of topics with which he educated his readers, while the cartoony illustrations of Jews are what got the most attention, and they are quite... well, you have people who like them, and then you have people who think it's just terrible to show Jews in such extremely ugly characters and so on. But what it was is that he especially, though, exposed the Jewish proclivity for unfairly gaining financial advantage over Gentiles. That was his main theme, and people got distracted with the illustrations. But the illustrations were meant to really bring home that these people were dangerous, unappealing, and unlike the Germans. Very, you know, make them very unlike the Germans. There was always this contrast between the nice-looking, normal-looking German people and then these really strange-looking, alien-looking Jews. So to talk about this man and get it straight about what kind of a person he was born in 1885, which made him 4 years older than Adolf Hitler, in Fleinhausen in Bavaria. It was a kingdom of Bavaria at the time. And he was one of nine children of a Catholic couple, a teacher Friedrich Streicher and his wife Anna. Now, her maiden name was Weiss, W-E-I-S-S. Now, you know, I read seeing in passing here and there, looking up things for this, that people say he was a half Jew. Not true. He didn't have any Jewishness in him. But this might have probably came from the fact that his mother's name was Weiss, and lots of Jews have taken that name. Weiss is white in English, and, you know, I looked up the name because I knew that it was a German name, but I wanted to see what I could find out about it. And at Judaism 101, it says a lot of surnames that sound Jewish to Americans are simply German names, and it gives these examples first. Klein, Gross or Grossman, Weiss or Weiss, Weiss or Weissman, Rosen, Schwartz or Schwartzman, Siegel, Siegel or Sagel, and anything that contains a Berg, Stein, Mann, Thal, or Bluth. Well, of course, Mann certainly is not Jewish, but some of them have that too. You know, this is, I've talked about this before. It's so irritating. Jews come into a nation, place where they don't belong, and they start trying to disguise themselves and not be noticed and appear like normal like everyone else. And the first thing they do is take on German names. And then if there's enough of them that they seem to like certain names, or if others have it, they take that one too. So then you have a lot of Jews with certain names. I know a couple named Gross, in where I live, a lovely couple, German. And, Sam Gross is his name, as a matter of fact. That could really sound Jewish. But they're not, and I don't think he has any in his history or, you know, I mean, I wouldn't suspect anything like that. But you find a lot of Jews using the name Gross and, of course, Weiss also. So that's probably where that came from. These people who want to turn all these Nazis into Jews will use anything like that and just without caring that it's true or not. Julius Stryker worked as an elementary school teacher like his father. So, you know, he grew up in this Catholic family. He remained Catholic all his life. He remained, fairly religious. And he became a school teacher. There's nothing too awful in that. You know, he wasn't some kind of a brute or working as a prize fighter or something. Not that there's anything wrong with that. In 1909, he began his political career, joining the German Democratic Party. In 1913, he married Kunigunda Roth. Now, there's another Jew name. She was a baker's daughter in Nuremberg. Now, Roth is another name that Jews have taken. And I thought, well, there's another reason people could say, oh, he's Jewish, you know, he had a Jewish wife. Well, that's another German name. I'm not going to go into any more detail on that. But obviously, you find Roth a lot in town names, city names in Germany. And so, it's what it is. They had two sons, Lothar, born 1915, and Elmar, born 1918. Now, again, this is all very regular and ordinary and normal. You know, they only had two children, two boys, and, you know, it's not, he came from a family of nine. He was Catholic, but he didn't force his wife to have bunches of children. I think he was known for having extramarital affairs, but maybe that's part of the reason they didn't have any more. But anyway, excuse me, I clear my throat. But in any case, didn't clear out, I'm sorry. In any case, that's that was him. He wasn't brutish. Let me put it that way. He didn't seem to ever behave as a brute. I read that he worshipped his mother, who he later called the fortress of his childhood, and said that his first remembrance of Jews was at age five, when his mother cried after she had ordered fabric from a Jewish shop, which turned out to be of inferior quality. She told him, excuse me, this is just like a Jew. And Stryker also said that his family was very devoutly Catholic, and that the village priest once told the congregation that the Jews had fought Christ bitterly, finally crucifying him. Stryker said, that was my first inkling that the nature of the Jews was peculiar. Oh, he never, a lot of quotes from him come from his testimony at the IMT, the Nuremberg Tribunal, or when he was talking to the, you know, they have these psychiatrists and counselors and so on, and it's all down in writing, so anything that they said to anybody is all there. And this would have been some of the things he was saying, so he never denied anything. He was always very honest and straightforward. He didn't try to twist things around to make himself look different than he was. And you know, this story, I was thinking, well, people could say, well, this story about his mother crying that she got inferior fabric from a Jewish shop, he could just make that up. Well, he could make it up. I mean, I have stories like that, and I could make them up too, but they're not made up, because this did happen. This did happen, and it happened often enough where you order something because you can't go and buy it and see it if it's something that doesn't, you know, isn't available that way, so you have to order it. And then when you get it, it's not what it was said to be. I've had that experience myself. So I believe he's telling the truth. In February 1919, after the war, and also did I leave out here somehow? Might have been somewhere else. He served in World War I, even though he was married and had children then. His first son was born in 1915, but he went ahead and joined up right away, and he also had a record of bravery in the war. He won the Iron Cross. He did some dangerous missions, because that's just the kind of person He is, and he was. That's the kind of person he was. And he and Hitler always got along very well. I'll get into that. Hitler liked him because they had a lot in common in this way. They did have a lot in common. And so but in 1919, at the end of the war, he became active in the anti-Semitic German Nationalist Protection and Defense Federation. These groups, there were a number of groups like that. And notice it says it's anti-Semitic because it was German nationalist, and to protect and defend. The idea was that the Jews had conspired with Bolshevik traitors during the war in trying to subject Germany to communist rule. That is, of course, that there was, an example of that is that there was a communist takeover of Bavaria in 1918, which lasted several months and put the fright into people. And then the Freikorps developed, and they really, a real right wing really became much stronger to combat that. And in 1920, he left that because they were complaining. This was the next one. Okay. He left that and went into the German Socialist Party, which was a group that whose platform was close to that of the young NSDAP that Hitler was running. Its program of this, the one that he joined, German Socialist Party, was based on the ideas of the mechanical engineer Alfred Brunner, including socialist ideas like the takeover of the financial sector by the state and cutting back the interest-based economy. Stryker sought to move the German socialists in a more outspoken anti-Semitic direction in this party, and there was opposition to that because, you know, a lot of these Germans weren't willing to see it that way. And so he left there and took his substantial following. He had developed a substantial following because he spoke out the truth, and a lot of people liked it and looked up to him. And he went into the German Working Community, which was another organization, in 1921, and he was hoping to unite the various anti-Semitic Volkisch movements. So he was always anti-Semitic. In 1921, he visited Munich to hear Adolf Hitler speak. People had been telling him, "Have you heard Adolf Hitler speak?" And so he was in Nuremberg, and he went to Munich to hear Adolf Hitler, and says it was an experience that left him transformed. Soon after that, he joined that party, the NSDAP, Hitler's party, and merged his personal following with Hitler's, almost doubling the party membership. Well, in 1922, the party was a couple, 3 years old, and they were doing fairly well. And now, this shows that Stryker had as big of a following and took them all and added that. And Hitler was no doubt grateful for that and happy about that. Now, so in May 1923, he was finally found his real home and his real mission and so on. And he founded his newspaper, Der Stürmer, which means the stormer, or more loosely, the attacker. From the outset, the chief aim of the paper was to promulgate anti-Semitic propaganda. And he said, the paper announced, "We will be slaves of the Jew, therefore he must go." Very, very direct. And, you know, was he right? Was he prophetic? Yes, yes, indeed, he was. You know, we are slaves of the Jew today. We need to admit that. We need to understand that. Everything that these people were saying and fighting for, that which is presented as so terrible. Oh, what horrible anti-Semitic things to say. But they were right. It was true. And now we are in the very condition that they were trying to prevent, and worse than even they probably could have imagined. So, or maybe they could have imagined it. I guess they did. Anyway, I like this Der Stürmer, the attacker. And this is, I see Julius, I didn't always, I guess, but I see Julius Stryker it's hard to say, there were so many great National Socialists, but, you know, as someone who has been given a bad rap, because he was willing. He was one thing he was, along with being honest, he was courageous. He was brave, and he's outspoken, and he always said exactly what he thought and believed. And most people won't do it because they think, oh, that's too much. We can't say that. I think more and more that we need that, or we need more people who do that. And Hitler thought so, too, because he always supported him. And he was willing to go on the attack, and that's what he did in that paper, and he never backed down. You can't find too many people with that kind of character. Well, I get tired of using the word courage. It's something more than that. It's some kind of steel. It's some kind of a principle that is he just was made of good stuff. He was made of good stuff rather than the opposite. He participated in the beer hall putsch in Munich. That was when Hitler thought that he could, in a moment of where the government was weak, he could take over by force. But that failed, and after that, he decided he would never do that again. And he would go through the process of the votes, the democratic process. But Stryker participated in that. He marched with Hitler in the front row. He braved the bullets and the Munich police. See, he was always that way. And afterwards, when the Nazi Party was legalized again and reorganized in 1925, after Hitler was released from prison and they had to reorganize again, Stryker was appointed Gauleiter of the Bavarian region of Franconia, which included his hometown of Nuremberg, and that was a party position, but the party was, that's all there was now was a party. Hitler wasn't in power in the government yet, but in the party, the Gauleiters were the top, almost like you'd think of one's cabinet, they weren't really, they were the leaders of the different regions, and he was the leader of the region that he was in, which included Nuremberg. And at that time, he was elected to the Bavarian Landtag, or parliament, or representative, people's representative chamber, which was, he had this following, and he was able to be elected to this legislature. And it gave him a margin of parliamentary immunity, a little bit of a safety net that helped him with his racist message, because people were trying to, attack him on that all the time. His attacks on Jews in the pages of Der Stürmer brought lawsuits against him. He had lots of lawsuits. He didn't let them bother him. He just went there to the, and answered them. And he sometimes lost. He mostly lost, but he didn't lose every one, but he mostly lost. But he thought that he won in the end because as he said, something always sticks. And he was able to put out the widest possible dissemination of his message this way, because he got press coverage of these lawsuits. It actually didn't always, while these people who brought the suits against him usually won, they weren't always helped by it. His message kept growing. It says that the rules of the court provided Stryker with an arena to humiliate his opponents. We have people today who say we should go into court for the very reason of getting these our message out there, and to point out and be able to point out all to point out that what's wrong with our enemy's message, and you can really do that in court. And this is what he did, and so it wasn't like he was some kind of a loser. He was doing it. He had good purpose in doing it, and he accomplished a lot. He saw when he lost in the courtroom, he saw it as a badge of honor, because he said the courts were corrupt anyway. And Der Stürmer's official slogan was "Die Juden sind unser Unglück," which is "The Jews are our misfortune." And many people think that that came from him. Other people think it came from Joseph Goebbels, but it didn't come from either one. It was actually the phrase first occurred with Heinrich von Treschke, who was a well-known scholar, philosopher, writer, a political person, he tended to be anti-Semitic and became more and more so. And he is the one who first said that, the Jews are our misfortune. And Stryker used it as the official slogan of his newspaper. And it's, of course, it's a well-known phrase now. Now, here's how he operated. It says, Stryker also combed the pages of the Talmud and the Old Testament. Now, this is something so many people do today, but he was doing it then in search of passages which could paint their ancient Jewish authors as harsh or cruel. You have to, to find the truth about how the Jews, what the Jews are like. And in 1929, this close study of Jewish scripture helped convict Stryker in a case known as the Great Nuremberg Ritual Murder Trial. 1929, his familiarity with Jewish text was proof to the court that his attacks were religious in nature, because you could say things about other races if it wasn't racial, but if it was religious, or if it was racial, or if it was racial or something else, political, but not if it was religious. So they said that they found him guilty because he was attacking them on religious grounds, and they imprisoned him for 2 months. The press reaction was critical of Stryker, but when he, after his conviction, he came out of the courtroom to find hundreds of cheering supporters, and within months, Nazi Party membership surged to its highest levels yet. So that's something to think about when people say we shouldn't talk about the Jews, or we shouldn't talk in extremes about the Jews, or we shouldn't include Jews as all Jews included in the same, in the same category and so on. Because that never works. They're not accomplishing anything. But if you behave like Stryker did, he was accomplishing a lot, and this is why Hitler liked him. He never wavered in his support for Stryker when the other party and government officials wanted to get rid of him. He declared that Der Stürmer was his favorite newspaper and saw to it that each weekly issue was posted for public reading in special glassed-in display cases known as Stürmerkasten. And the newspaper reached a peak circulation of 600,000 in 1935. Hermann Göring hated Stryker, and Joseph Goebbels didn't like him either, and advised Hitler to get rid of him and shut him up and so on. But Hitler would never do that. Eventually, he had to not allow him in certain circles that were going on, making decisions and so on. But he never did take away his post of Gauleiter of the Nuremberg area. He allowed him to keep that. Hitler was under pressure because of Stryker, but personally he liked him and saw him as one of his most loyal and effective supporters. So just one little thing here before I get into the trial. Stryker was ordered to take, he took part in the establishment of the Institute for the Study and Elimination of Jewish Influence on German Church Life that was organized together with the German Christians and the Ministry of Public Enlightenment and Propaganda, which would have been Goebbels, and the Reich Ministry of Education and the Reich Ministry of the Churches. And this whole thing was considered anti-Semitic, this whole Christian movement, to get rid of the Old Testament, what a lot of them thought should be done. But anyway, that was the only thing that he really was a part of, other than what he did as a Gauleiter and his own things that he did. So when Germany surrendered to the Allied armies in May 1945, a Stryker said later, this would have been when talking to the people in the IMT, he decided to commit suicide, but instead of doing that, he married his lifelong secretary, Adele Tappe. He was really in love with this woman, and his wife had died in 1943. So she must, you know, for a woman to marry a man in such a predicament as he was in May 1945, she must have thought very highly of him. That's what I think. She was his secretary, so she was not some kind of tramp or anything. And she was a decent woman, obviously, I'm quite sure. So, but she loved him. So again, that speaks very highly of him. And they went into hiding, but only a short time later, he was captured in Austria by a group of American officers led by Major Henry Plitt, who was Jewish. Well, naturally, they had these Jews in charge of all these, searching for these Nazis. And when you got in their hands, you were in for it. So during his trial, Stryker claimed that he had been mistreated by Allied soldiers after his capture. By his account, they ordered him to, I'm going to go into the better description of this, which is that during his trial, when he first came into the courtroom, he passed a note to his lawyer, Dr. Hans Marx, because he was on trial with all the major war criminals, and so he was a major war criminal, although he never had anything to do with the war, and or with policy, or with anything to do with the camp system or any of that. Nothing to do with it. The only thing he did was run that newspaper, basically, that they found objection to. Anyway, he said in this note to his lawyer, who was Dr. Hans Marx, that the Jews and Negroes had tortured him in his cell. A photograph backed up his charges. They took photographs of him, and somehow they got him. His attorney got him. And they showed him standing naked with black and blue marks and a sign around his neck proclaiming Julius Stryker, King of the Jews. You know, now here they're, you know, they knew he was still a Catholic and a believer. And so they are not only attacking him and the National Socialists, they are attacking Christianity, they're attacking Jesus Christ here. Think that's real funny to call him King of the Jews. And in this note, I'm quoting from it, he wrote to his lawyer, two niggers undressed me and tore my shirt in two. I kept only my pants. Being handcuffed, I could not pull them up when they fell down. So now I was naked. 4 days. On the fourth day, I was so cold that my body was numb. I couldn't hear anything. Every 2 to 4 hours, even in the night, niggers came along under command of a white man and hammered at me. Cigarette burns on the nipples. Fingers gouged into eye sockets. Eyebrows and chest hair pulled out. Genitals beaten with an ox whip. Testicles very swollen. Spat at. In quotation marks, mouth open, that is, they ordered him to open his mouth, and probably in their rudimentary German, and was spat into. When I refused to open, my jaws were pried apart with a stick, and my mouth spat into, beaten with a whip, swollen dark blue whelps all over my body, photographed naked, jeered at, wearing an old army greatcoat which they hung round me. Unquote. So when his attorney protested the mistreatment of Stryker to the court, the inquisitors erupted with outrage. I guess this would be the prosecutors. They immediately ordered that the motion be struck from the trial record as highly improper. Stryker twice brought up his being tortured, I suppose when he was on the stand, because he did take the stand. And rather than ask for an investigation, the judges ordered his statements deleted from the record. They held him in contempt of court for even revealing the matter. Julius Stryker was charged with only 2 of the 4 counts that most of his co-defendants faced. Even this grotesque tribunal could not charge him with conspiring to wage aggressive war or war crimes, for he had been out of government in Germany since 1940. The inquisitors settled for charging him, these are prosecutors, settled for charging him with crimes against humanity. Count 4, by inciting racial hatred through his writings. Well, that sounds very modern, doesn't it? That's what Germany stuck with, that you're just as much a criminal if you incite racial hatred through writings. Stryker's lawyer, Hans Marx, told the court that his client had no knowledge of any Holocaust and indeed opposed violence against the Jews. Stryker boldly took the stand to deny that any so-called Holocaust ever took place. And this is what I mean about what exceptional courage he had. How many took the stand, and would they take the stand and deny that a Holocaust took place? Because their lawyers were telling them, don't do that. Don't try to deny that any of this stuff happened, because that will only make it worse for you. Because that they've got it. They knew that it was a settled thing that it did happen, and you couldn't deny that it happened. Now, all you could do was have some kind of feeble defense. So that's why most of them listened to their lawyers and took the defense that they didn't know anything about it. They were just following orders, and they never heard of it, which was true. So they weren't responsible. They never made any such decisions, et cetera, et cetera. But not Stryker. Stryker decided, you know, always had to tell the truth. And he always had to, he just had to do it without any consideration for taking any other path. And so he got on the stand and he denied it. And he said he was the first one, it says, to expose this outrageous fraud. The first one. And he repeatedly stated, quote, I did not know, in parentheses, of any developing Holocaust, in parentheses. And again, I would not have believed it. To this day, I do not believe that 5 million were killed. I consider it technically impossible that could have happened. I do not believe it. I have not received proof of that up until now. Now, he wasn't thrown out of court or anything, but of course, these people who thought, whose lawyers told them what to do, and they followed that, they were encouraged that if they followed the rules of the court and so on and didn't upset anybody too much, that they might get life in prison or, you know, some sentence, but they wouldn't get death. Well, they were wrong, because they were marked for death from the beginning. And so they could have said anything they wanted to say. It wouldn't have made any difference to their sentence. Stryker was probably the only one who figured that out or had the courage, the boldness. And I'm not saying these other men weren't courageous. Not for a second. I'm not trying to say that. They were. There's a lot of great guys here in this group that I, you know, think very highly of. But, you know, here was this guy who's been so defamed, Julius Stryker, who put on, you know, truthfully, the most honest and brave show of all. And it says here that it should be noted that he was considered a respectful and sincere witness. He didn't mouth off. He was not talking back to people. He was not speaking crudely. He was respectful and sincere, but he spoke what he believed always was the truth. And he wouldn't go along with saying otherwise. And it says that his wartime psychologist, Douglas Kelly, who examined him, said that he, Kelly, was convinced that Stryker firmly believed in the truth of his views on the Jews. So that's a pretty good statement right there. And Stryker was charged with count one of the indictment, conspiring to wage aggressive war. And of course, he had nothing to do with the war. So since he was under house arrest even during the war, the Nazis had convinced Hitler to put him under some kind of house arrest. I don't know. So he couldn't come out, and he still ran his newspaper. I think so. He couldn't come out and do things they didn't want him to do. So anyway, this easily disproven charge was dropped. I'm not clear about that statement, I have to tell you. I didn't look any of this up, so I'm not clear about the meaning of that. But anyway, this left him facing count four. The only thing that they charged him with was count four, crimes against humanity by stirring up hatred against the Jews. To this day, Jews in America are trying to create such a crime here through a passage of anti-hate laws. This is a brazen attack upon the constitutionally guaranteed First Amendment. And I have to move along fast here because I got to get in the hanging story. But repeatedly, Stryker stated in court or elsewhere that my life's mission is to unmask the Jews. That's what he told the court. Yeah, that's what he told the court. And the Jews, he says, the Jews are a race and not a religion. My goal was not to persecute the Jews, but to enlighten Gentiles to put them on guard. All right. In okay, the 1934 issue of Der Stürmer that they objected to more than anything else at this tribunals was the one in which featured the centuries old accusation that extremist Orthodox Jews would crucify a Christian child during Passover using the blood in a ritual ceremony. This accusation is known among Jews as blood libel. Stryker thoroughly researched this subject. He said he cited in his article there in the magazine, he cited many sources with footnotes. His defense attorney asked him to reply to the prosecution's charge that he had no documentary proof that such crimes were once practiced by certain Jews. And he answered the sources were given in that issue. There was reference made to a book written in Greek by a former rabbi who had been converted to Christianity. There was a reference to a publication of a high clergyman of Milan. Not even did Jews raise objections to that book. He went on to say, ritual murder is referred to in court files, which are located in Rome. There are pictures in it which show that in 23 cases, the church itself has dealt with the question that the Catholic Church has canonized 23 non-Jews killed by ritual murder. Pictures of sculptures, that is, of stone monuments, were shown as illustrations. Everywhere in Der Stürmer, the source was pointed out, but in this connection, I should like to say we never wanted to assert that all Jewry was ready now to commit ritual murders, but it is a fact that within Jewry there exists a sect which engaged in these murders. I have asked my counsel to submit to the court a file from Pisek in Czechoslovakia, or Pisek, a very recent proceedings. A court there has confirmed a case of ritual murder, and so on. And at this point, no, here he said, thus, in conclusion, I must say, and at this point, his testimony was cut off by Judge Jackson, you know, our American main judge there, who stated, I object to this statement. He ought to be returned to his cell, and any further statements that he wishes to make, transmitted through his counsel to this court, he should be held in contempt of court. So he was not allowed to continue with that. But this is the way he was treated in court, and he was found guilty of this one charge and condemned to death by hanging based on that. And so now the day of the hanging is taking place, and we have an article by Kingsbury Smith, who was a journalist and out and eyewitness, who wrote about it. He's obviously British. And as they, he writes this, as they went, this is just part of it. I'm reading what he wrote. As they went to the gallows, most of the 10 endeavored to show bravery. Excuse me. All except for Rosenberg made brief last-minute statements on the scaffold, but the only one to make any reference to Hitler or the Nazi ideology in his final moments was Julius Streicher. And then he describes, I think it might be interesting to describe the where it took place. Three black-painted wooden scaffolds stood inside the brightly lit gymnasium of the prison that they had been held at, a room approximately 33 feet wide by 80 feet long with plaster walls, in which cracks showed. The gymnasium had been used only 3 days before by the American security guards for a basketball game. Two gallows were used alternately. The third was a spare for use if needed. The men were hanged one at a time, but to get the executions over with quickly, the military police would bring in the next man while the prisoner who preceded him still was dangling at the end of the rope, although they were not visible because they were lowered, you know, into below the platform. The 10 once, well, they, you know, they have to be sarcastic about these. The 10 once great men in Hitler's Reich, walked up 13 wooden steps. I didn't know if that was symbolic or something. They had 13 steps up to the top of the platform. which was 8 feet high and 8 feet square. I don't know what that might mean something too. You never know. Ropes were suspended from a crossbeam supported on two posts. A new one was used for each man. Anyway, he describes that Ribbentrop and Keitel were first because Goring was supposed to be first, but he committed suicide, you know, with that cyanide capsule 2 hours before the scheduled time of this hanging was to take place. So they were all upset about that. So they brought first Ribbentrop in, and there's a description here of him. They had to, well, here, this, here it says, at the end, when, after those two were finished being hung, there was a pause in the proceedings. And, the American colonel directing the executions asked the American general representing the United States on the Allied Control Commission if those present could smoke. An affirmative answer brought cigarettes into the hands of almost every one of the 30 odd persons present. And then they, no smoking was announced again. And then came Kaltenbrunner and Rosenberg. As they said, Rosenberg was the only one who refused to make a statement, that was not interested in making a statement. And after that came Hans Frank and Wilhelm Frick. And that's all described in this article. I'll put the URL to that on the program page. Then they brought in Julius Streicher. Well, he was very different from the others. He came in at 2:12 a.m. And now I'm going to read what was written by this Kingsbury Smith. And notice how they like to use insult and ridicule when writing about these men as much as possible. So what he says about Julius Streicher, he writes, while his manacles were being removed and his bare hands bound, this ugly, dwarfish little man, wearing a threadbare suit and a well-worn bluish shirt buttoned to the neck, but without a tie, glanced at the three wooden scaffolds rising menacingly in front of him. Then he glanced around the room, his eyes resting momentarily upon the small group of witnesses. You know, most of the people, now was Streicher dwarfish or ugly? Well, some people might think he was ugly. I don't see him as ugly. I see him as having a kind of a strong face, but I don't think he was dwarfish. And maybe, you know, he was a couple inches maybe shorter than Hitler, or an inch and a half or something. And they want to make Hitler short. You know, they want to say Hitler was 5'8". Hitler wasn't 5'8". I can't believe it. You try to look at these pictures, unless all those Germans were some kind of short people. I mean, I would say Hitler was probably 5'10". But, you know, they, I don't know. I mean, I can't say for sure. I've never found anything that I could believe about that. But, I mean, when I was younger, my greatest height was 5'7", or just under 5'7", just short of 5'7". And, you know, I can't imagine that I was as tall as these men. They say that Streicher is probably 5'7" or 5'8". At least. So I think they're always trying to make these guys short, just because they want to compare it to, oh, well, you know, the Nazi ideal of the tall Aryan, and they're all short guys, and they all had dark hair and dark eyes and all this and that, none of which is true. Streicher had light eyes, and I don't know, he shaved his head. But it says that, but you know, he came in and he looked at everything. He was always wanted to know just what was what. I think this is a real symptom, a real characteristic of his, that he didn't shy away from knowing whatever there was to know. He wanted to know. And so when he came in, he wanted to see what was going on there. And he looked around at everything. And he looked at the witnesses. And then when they directed him to the gallows on the left, he walked steadily. They all walked steadily, says, to the first step. But then this writer says this, but his face was twitching. Well, I don't know if, you know, you don't know whether to believe that. They have to say some kind of things like that. Who knows? Then the guard, stopped him at the bottom. As the guard stopped him at the bottom of the steps, because they had this formality to say, please tell us what your name is, and they have to say their name. He uttered, his piercing scream, Heil Hitler. Well, here again, they're using the word scream. They're always using the word scream or screech when or shriek or something when they only mean a shout. I'm sure he didn't scream, but I imagine that he shouted it, Heil Hitler. And nobody else did that. And then this the writer says it sent a shiver down his back. And as the echo died away in this big room, the American colonel told him he needed to say his name. And you know what he said to him? He said, you know my name well. And they repeated the request to say his name, and he said out very loud, Julius Streicher. Then when he reached the platform, he cried out, I guess he wanted to be loud enough for everyone to hear him, now it goes to God. And he was pushed the last two steps to this spot, you know, right beneath the hangman's rope, so they say. And then the rope was being held back. And when he was suddenly swung, you know, they swing around suddenly to face the witnesses that are sitting there. And he says he glared at them, at the witnesses. Then he shouted, Purim Fest 1946. And this, we know that Purim is a Jewish holiday celebrated in the spring, commemorating the execution of Haman. But more than that, it caused the death by hanging of all these supporters of Haman. So it's like, you know, they saw that Adolf Hitler died. Oh, he cheated them too and killed himself rather than waiting for them to do it. But then all his followers were also being hung. And that's why what it has in common with Purim, which they don't mention in this account. The officer, because he had to do so, and said, ask the man if he has any last words. And his last words were, he shouted, the Bolsheviks will hang you one day. Then the black hood was put over his head, and he could be heard to say, Adele, my dear wife. Those were his actual last words. Then when the trap opened with a loud bang, he went down kicking, it said. He just probably couldn't not be, he was a fighter. He just could not be fighting. He just wasn't the silent type that was totally, you know, made their last statement and just tried to not show any response at all to it. Plus, it's better not to do that. But anyway, it says that his body was swinging wildly, and though he was under the platform now, groans could be heard, and the hangman, who had descended from the gallows platform, lifted the black canvas curtain and went inside under the gallows and did something and stopped the groans and brought the rope to a standstill because it had been moving before that. And after the writer says that everybody was of the opinion that that the hangman had grabbed the swinging body and pulled down on it, and that caused Streicher to be strangled, and that was the end of that. So I have just reached, I've still got a few minutes, so that was the end of, well, I have a lot more I could say, but, you know, this man, has been hated so much by the Jews. He is so hated because he told the truth about the Jews, and he wasn't afraid to do it to the extent that that he thought was the truth. And I don't have any email questions or any calls. So how would I like to sum this up? Yeah, he told the truth, and he was defiant and truthful to the end. He went along with the restrictions placed on him by Hitler because of all the other National Socialists. You know, like Joseph Goebbels, he was very outspoken. He was a great man. I love Joseph Goebbels. But he was concerned with, and so was Goering even more, I think. They had to be concerned with international opinion because... Maybe, you know, during the war and so on, when still they didn't want to be seen as crude Jew haters. They knew enough that that wasn't good for them. But Stryker was a different kind of man, and he was just thought in terms of Germany. He wasn't responsible for the government or in the government. He was in the party, and he felt his best thing was to put out his newspaper and educate everyone, and it did educate. It was very effective, even though it's portrayed today, presented today as being this ugly, crude thing. It's just full of these grotesque drawings of Jews and just, you know, real ugly anti-Semitism and creating hatred. No, he was talking about all kinds of things, and it was good that he did so, and we need to do more of that, which is one reason why I'm picking him out, because we need to look at Julius Stryker in a better way, and I'd like to see more of those magazines to see what was actually inside of them. At calvin.edu, you can see a lot of cartoon drawings, and on another page you can see a lot of book covers, because he put out a lot of little books for children, and these were very good too, very nice art in them, although of course Jews don't like it. But I mean, here we go. I mean, this is two men, Arthur Rudolph and Julius Stryker, who were especially targeted to be persecuted in a special way by Jews, because the Jews decided that they had done a lot of damage to their cause. So, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for listening. I hope you'll be back next week, and have a good rest of your weekend. This is Carolyn Yeager saying goodbye for Saturday Afternoon with Carolyn.
Thanks for listening. And be sure to visit Carolyn's website at carolynyager.com.